From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. This morning, our monthly look at diet and nutrition. This is a topic we take up once a month. Our guest this month is Karen Chapman Novikovsky. She is a professor of nutrition at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her research interests include diabetes and osteoporosis. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments this morning as we warm up and you call in. We'll begin by talking about diabetes, osteoporosis, and diet. Do feel free, though, to call in at any time with your concerns, comments, and questions. You can join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Professor Chapman Novikovsky is recognized internationally in the field of nutrition education. She's the co-director of the Illinois Center for Soy Foods. She's also editor-in-chief of the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior. She joined the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences in 1991. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Good morning and welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you.
It's so nice to have you here. So I want to talk with you first about diabetes, particularly type 2, because we're seeing such an increase in it. Could you talk with us about the role diet and activity or inactivity play in type 2 diabetes?
Well, the very simple answer then is that as we get heavier, the risk for type 2 diabetes increases. Because as we get heavier, then the cells are less sensitive to insulin. So the blood glucose then rises in the bloodstream, and that's type 2 diabetes. A more difficult question then is to how do we stop that? And certainly not everyone who gains weight or is overweight will develop type 2 diabetes. It's really only about 25% of those people who are overweight. But if you look at the risk, that's a pretty high risk.
Yeah. And in terms of diabetes and other diseases like heart disease, high blood pressure, that kind of thing, are there links?
Diabetes is linked to cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, kidney disease, going blind, peripheral vascular disease. The list goes on. Because it's that blood glucose, when it gets high in the blood, then it damages everything else.
Okay. So we want to prevent type 2 diabetes. So we want to take a look at our diet and we want to get moving.
Yes, absolutely.
And I wanted to ask you as well, are there links between diabetes and osteoporosis? Because these are two of your interests.
It is. And with the high blood glucose affecting all of our other systems, then, of course, we need to look at the bone. As more and more we recognize that bone isn't just like a rock, it's a living tissue. It turns over. It needs nutrients as well. And so our research and other researchers have found that with the high blood glucose, say in type 1 and type 2 diabetes, that both the quantity and the quality of the bone can be affected.
Okay. So how
again,
we...
that blood glucose has to come down.
Yeah. Okay. So how do we do that?
Well, the myth out there is that if you don't eat sugar, then the sugar in your blood won't be high. But that's not really true because all the carbohydrate that you eat then is digested and metabolized to sugar, glucose. So it's not sugar. A long time ago now, 1994, the American Diabetes Association looked at all of the research and found it's not sugar that people who have type 2 or even type 1 diabetes can have sugar. It's the overall calories and the amount of carbohydrate, all of carbohydrate, not just sugar, that really needs to be controlled and balanced then with medication if diet and exercise aren't balancing those calories out.
Okay. And why do you suppose then we are so concerned about sugar?
Well, sugar is something we love and we love to hate. You know, there's lots of myths out. It's going to make you sweet. You crave sugar. It's going to make your blood glucose go up. It makes kids hyperactive. Most of all of those myths are surrounded by really good anecdotal evidence. Certainly, you have an aunt who holds on to that, or your kids are hyperactive. But the research base doesn't support those myths. So, I don't think sugar is bad. Most of the work that we've done in dentistry have gotten away from those sticky sugars and fluoridation, and that's really only the bad thing that there's evidence out there for sugar.
Okay, but we're very concerned about sugar and sweeteners in particular.
Well, the added sugars do add calories, and in that regard, they need to be less in our diet. Avoid it more often than not. Certainly things like soda, sweetened drinks that don't need to have that high carbohydrate level add to our total calorie intake with what we call less dense, less nutrient-dense foods.
Why as a population are we putting on more weight? Are we growing heavier?
Well, again, the easy answer, Celeste, is that we're eating too much and exercising less. But our lives are very complicated. We have less time to eat during the day, less time to think about meals that we're cooking. We're working longer hours. We have more stresses in our lives. We're trying to devote time to our kids and our spouses. We have financial concerns. And so, unfortunately, when we've done focus groups, when I say, what are your top 10 concerns, food and nutrition aren't up there. And I'm always horrified, but that's my profession. You know, they're worried about their kids in school. People are worried about their finances. And so even though it's something of national importance and personal importance, in our day-to-day balance of things, very often it hits the bottom.
Yeah. What about, tell us a little bit about, I'm interested in the issue of stress. You mentioned finances and you mentioned children. That can add to the stress. And I'm wondering, what kind of impact do our stress levels have on, could they have an impact on blood glucose? Could they have an impact on our overall health?
Oh, certainly. Any kind of physical or psychological stress can trigger hormones in our bodies that make the blood glucose go up. So if you have an infection, a cold, the flu, that's a physical stress. Mm-hmm. If you fall and break a hip, that's a physical stress that will cause blood glucose to go up. But also any kind of psychological stress. Normally that's counterbalanced by the insulin in our body, but if you're already having a difficult time, if you have insulin resistance, then it can lead to higher blood glucose levels than what you would have without the stress. It's that fight or flight sort of reaction that originally was there to help us get out quickly, but the kind of stresses that we have today are not always those get out quickly kind of stresses.
Yeah. It's not appropriate to fight or flight. So you're there.
Correct.
Yeah. Let's take a call. This is a listener on line 4. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm one of those people who doesn't produce insulin correctly, and when it gets produced, my cell walls won't accept it too well. So I take on, two different types of medicines to take care of that. I was wondering about, in general, if you can speak in such terms, what's the best blood pressure range you should keep your blood pressure in? And secondly, what's the best range for keeping your blood sugar in range? I usually, basically, I fast every night. I stop eating at 7 in the evening, and I usually, end up at 8. So I have a full 12 hours without any food. And as you said, the stress factor is important. I'd been in the hospital for some time. I noticed when I got back in my own home and bed and stuff, my blood sugar was a little higher than usual, but my meal intake was basically unchanged. So I wonder if you could talk about those two things, if possible.
Okay.
Sure. I can talk in general. And in general, blood pressure should be less than 140 over 80.
Okay.
Your physician would have their own target goals for your blood glucose. But in general, we want a fasting level that's less than 110, or better still, looking at your hemoglobin A1C, which is a reflection of the past 3 months, and not just a snapshot of the day. And the guidelines from the American Association of Endocrinologists suggest that having a hemoglobin A1C less than 7, or sometimes even less than 6.5. However, for each person, then, those target goals need to be individualized.
Yeah. Well, now, since they've gotten away from the 6.1, haven't they, then? I remember one time when I first started out, that was sort of the mantra, and that has changed. My A1C is usually like 6.2. I usually get that done every 4 months by my doctor, and no one has said too much about it. That you know, that's okay, you're doing a good job, blah, blah, blah. And the she likes 130 or less on the blood pressure, as far as that goes. Then one thing I've noticed lately is that I've been running mainly between 100 and 110. Then all of a sudden it's jumped up to like 117, 122. And I'm figuring it must be some kind of inactivity because I'm eating basically the same thing that I normally eat. But I've had these side issues of being in the hospital twice in the last couple of months. So I'm presuming that the stress factor there is playing some playing a role, at least in making it get a little bit higher. Would that be true?
I think it could be true. I was just reading this week from one of the American Diabetes Association journals that as much as we try to pinpoint the cause for these fluctuations in blood glucose, that very often we can't be sure, and you need to do the best that you can every day and know that sometimes that blood glucose will bump up a little bit, and continue to do the best that you can every day, and usually then that comes back down into your target range.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question that deals with a friend of mine who I'm trying to educate in some ways. He is a group, which I've come across a few, do this, eat a big jelly roll and shoot themselves with their insulin. And I said something to my doctor about it, and she says high readings will cause problems eventually no matter what. And I was wondering what's the considered about that. He's in his late 60s, but he still does this. I'll just take my insulin or increase it. That'll take care of the blood sugar, which it does after he takes it and, you know, measures himself. He's got it back down. But I was wondering about these spikes that lasts for some period of time before it gets the insulin into him and it starts working. Whether over a period of time that is going to cause him some problems.
Well, there's two interesting.
Start yelling at him.
Well, there's two interesting things there. Very often, what your physician or nurse practitioner will instruct you on, if you're taking insulin, short-acting insulin, is how many carb units or grams of carbohydrate per unit of insulin. And so you can balance a jelly roll on the carbohydrate in there with the units of insulin, as you say, and cover that pretty well. What usually happens, though, two things, is that it may not cover that postprandial or after eating blood glucose as well. And that also will show up in hemoglobin A1Cs, and those high spikes then also cause tissue damage. But the insulin makes that glucose, which is energy, get into the cell. And so with those higher calorie foods, even if you're balancing them with insulin, you could gain weight, which then makes the insulin resistance worse, or any of the other complicating factors worse with the weight gain.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we nailed him down. I got to start talking to him. His A1C sometimes is at 11.6. often it's in the eights. I've tried to talk to him about, you know, about the blood glucose. You know, what you got to look at is little pieces of matter running around and bumping into small vessels, like in your, you know, your retina and stuff like that. And that in the long run, you're going to do yourself harm, even though this afternoon, say, for example, you take your blood sugar in, and it's within the range the doctor likes. But these little spikes, I'm assuming that they're cause problems over a period of time. I'm lucky. I'm just on the pills. I'm pretty much under control. And recently, because of the weather and having a back problem, I'm not as active as I should be. And sure enough, I've seen a small rise in my blood sugar, if I think of everything else as being the same, which essentially it is. Well, thank you. I will get back on my soapbox and give him a long talk.
Thanks for the call this morning. This is Focus. Did you want to add anything to there at the end?
Well, I think it's really important. One thing that I didn't bring up, and certainly that caller was talking about, is checking your blood glucose. Many people who have type 2 diabetes maybe will check it once a year if they go into their doctor. But unless you know that you are reaching your target goals, then checking your blood glucose in the morning, fasting, and once in a while after a meal to see how well that's coming down would be an important topic to talk to your doctor about.
This is Focus, and we're talking this morning about diet and nutrition. Our guest is Karen Chapman Novakovsky. She's a professor of nutrition at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, join us with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to give us a call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and the email address, if you'd like to drop us a line, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, one of the things that I'm concerned about as a woman at my age is osteoporosis, and I'm wondering, am I doing all that I can? Am I doing the best that I can, as you mentioned with the caller before? What kinds of things should I be thinking about, and how do I make sure I'm doing the best I can?
Well, there's been a lot of focus on osteoporosis, both in women and in men, as we get older. A lot of that focus recently has been on vitamin D and previously on calcium. Those are two very important nutrients. Mm-hmm. The rest of it has to do with having a healthy diet, calories for appropriate weight. It's probably the only condition that I can think of where being a little heavier is better for your bones. It's almost like exercising them without doing the resistance training. Certainly, there's the negative side of being too heavy in other conditions. With that, though, the bones also need all of those minerals that you get in fruits and vegetables and a lower sodium diet. We were talking before the program about sodium. Well, higher sodium diets have a negative effect on calcium in that with sodium excretion, if you have too much, it takes along its friend calcium. So a lower sodium diet is also good for your bones. Appropriate calories, calcium, vitamin D, and then the physical activity. Balance is really important as you get older, and something you don't even know that you've lost until you try and stand on one leg for a minute and a half and realize, I've lost that.
Mm-hmm. And can you get it back?
You can get it back. Flexibility and balance are something that you can practice, and it does come back. It's very important as strengthening the muscles that are going to pull on the bone and wake up those cells to make new bone, and aerobic activity then to keep that heart pumping.
Okay, there's where I'm not doing so well. Let's take another call. This is a listener on line one. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yes. Recently in the news, in the fine print of the news, there have been some articles about shortages of butter in Scandinavian countries. And it seems that one of the things this is attributed to is a fad diet there called the a high-fat, low-carb diet. I wonder if you've heard of that and if you have any comments on it.
I have not heard of that, but thank you for bringing that to my attention. That's a new one for me. There's been lots and lots of different forms of fad diets or non-fad diets, increasing and decreasing carbohydrates, increasing and decreasing protein, and increasing and decreasing fat. I don't think that as a scientific community we have the ultimate distribution of those macronutrients for the diet. In general, most country guidelines suggest that lower fat, perhaps a little higher protein, and, you know, a 50% distribution from carbohydrate is a healthier diet. I haven't heard of a high-fat diet, though.
Well, this seems to promote high-fat, kind of disregarding protein, but that goes along with it. There is a website called Eat Like a Swede that will give you some of the background on it.
All right. Thanks. I'll check it out.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. You mentioned that before the program got underway this morning, you and I had talked a little bit about sodium. We get too much salt in our diets. And one of the culprits is something we might not suspect. There's an article in the Tribune today, the Chicago Tribune, about how bread plays a role, can play a role in how much sodium we take in during the day. And if you have a bread item at each meal, you are taking in a number of slices or, you know, of bread or rolls or what have you. So when you take a look at those packages in the supermarket of breads and rolls and other bread items, what should we look for? What's a reasonable amount of sodium per serving in a bread item?
Well, that's a more difficult question than you realize. So if we're supposed to be consuming 2,300 milligrams of sodium per day, if you have certain conditions or if you're a little bit older, that drops down to 1,500 or even 1,200 milligrams per day. It's really, really hard to achieve those without finding low sodium products mm-hmm. in that 1500 range. So for breads and yeast, it depends on how many other higher sodium products you're consuming. And so again, looking overall at the whole diet, but certainly if you would choose those less than 100 milligrams, then you have a better chance of hitting that 2300 milligrams per day. That means you have to read the label and the fine print, and that can get hard. I was just at the market last night, and the second highest sodium was from chicken, and that kind of surprised me, chicken and chicken dishes. And reading further into that, some chicken is infused with water with sodium. So I was looking at the chicken and the nutrition facts label at the market last night, and that really wasn't so bad in the fresh meat counter. It was less than 100 milligrams per serving, but the frozen chicken breast then doubled and tripled, sometimes four times that. And if you got the chicken with gravy and mashed potatoes sort of meal that you can microwave, then you're around 1,000 milligrams, which is half the sodium you should have for the day. So reading the label, once again, we're back to the label until the food producers change that a little bit more and start reducing the sodium.
Yeah, I have noticed in the supermarket there are lower sodium products or low sodium products, and I'm pleased that you know, some of the crackers that we eat now, you can buy hint of salt.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's a help. I really haven't done my homework thoroughly in terms of looking and adding it up, but I think that's encouraging. And, you know, I occasionally like to have cottage cheese, and that can be that's a high sodium food. But now they have a product out there that is, I think it's one-third less sodium than regular, and it tastes fine to me. So.
People who love cheese are in the higher sodium intake range, that's for sure. And sodium can be a key ingredient in producing those cheeses. I know certain food companies are looking at ways to lower the sodium.
And I suppose, though, once you do your homework and you kind of know what products you can use, then it's done, right?
Well, yes and no. Yeah. We've done a lot of work on how people recognize calcium in their diet, and you're commenting on, yeah, I like to have cottage cheese. We did some focus groups in Western Illinois a number of years ago, and about half of the women who thought they had pretty good calcium in their diet when we really looked at it didn't. And so, of course, they're not going to change. They think they're doing pretty good. Mm. And so I think that it's something that if you really want to know what to change, you need to know what you're doing, and maybe not just what you think you're doing, and taking a good look, either talking to a dietitian or a nutritionist, or they have a program online on myplate.gov that you can put in what you're eating, and it's going to give you a breakdown of how you're doing.
Why do we think we're doing better than we are?
Well, I think that the perception is that if you sprinkle cheese on a salad, salad's good, right? And
right.
You put cheese, it's calcium, that
right.
You got it made. And yet that salad may be higher fat and higher calories. A sprinkle of cheese is not really enough calcium. In class yesterday, we were talking about how many glasses of milk it would take for someone to meet the RDA for calcium if they were, and the vitamin D if they were over 70, and that was 6 glasses of milk. Well, that's a lot of milk. Yeah.
Yeah. What other foods can we turn to besides dairy for calcium?
Well, a lot of foods are fortified with calcium. That's the good news. The bad news is there's no federal regulation on who puts how much in what. And so, again, you're back to reading the food label or the front of the package to see what's a good source of calcium, which that would be 100 to 200 milligrams per serving. And then an excellent source would be over 200. So if you measure that all the time to a glass of milk, which is 300 milligrams, and thinking about getting 3 to 4 or 5 glasses about that much per day, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah. And a glass of milk is 8 ounces, a cup?
8 ounces are a cup, yep.
Okay, very good. This is Focus. We're talking this morning about diet and nutrition. Our guest this month, Karen Chapman Novakovsky. She's a professor of nutrition at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. We look forward to hearing from you. More after a short break.
Tomorrow, WILL and its community partners team up again to fight hunger. This year, for every pledge made to WILL, Common Ground Food Co-op will donate the cost of 8 meals to Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Your pledge supports the programs you depend on and fights hunger in our community.
This is Focus, and coming up today in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, David Inge will be in the host's chair, and he will talk about the heart. Our hearts beat roughly every second of our lives, pumping around 74 gallons of blood every hour once we become adults. But the heart is filled with more than the blood it pumps. It's also the source of a vast supply of stories, reflecting the fact that it has long been a central image for describing those qualities that make us human. Coming up in the 11 o'clock hour of the program today, David Inge will talk with two people, novelist Stephen Amidon and cardiologist Thomas Amidon. And as I understand it, they are brothers. They are authors of The Sublime Engine. This book is billed as a biography of the heart. Sounds like that will be a very interesting program. That's David Inge and Focus coming up at 11 o'clock this morning here on WILL Radio. So what do you think about the changes that we're talking about in terms of making healthier choices possible, healthier lifestyle possible, beginning when we're small, beginning in schools? There's a lot of efforts underway now to change what's available in the lunchroom and to get kids into greater physical activity. What's a foot and how much further do we need to go?
Well, Celeste, I think that schools have been chosen as a good venue for both healthier eating and physical activity because children spend a large part of their day there, rather at the home. But attention also has to be made to the home and the whole community. Some of the best strategies for schools involve including the teachers and the food service workers. I know there was some outrage in Chicago a few weeks ago with the food service workers wanting to have input on those healthy recipes. They felt they knew what their kids were going to eat and what they weren't going to eat. So certainly it's not an isolated, I'm going to go and do this to them. That doesn't work very well. But I think offering some healthier choices and having some education that includes involving the kids with what their goals are. Again, anytime you try and do something to another person, it doesn't usually work. They like to be involved in those choices as well.
So in before the program, you also mentioned that you have done some work in schools in doing that work with the schools. Tell us about that.
Well, we've been involved in using online education in both nutrition and physical activity in middle schools and looking at what factors seem to change behaviors of the students there. And we chose online because kids are online. They like technology. In one of the early pilots of that program, we found the kids were going back to the website after school, which is fabulous. We never told them they had to. It's like finding out they're studying when they don't have a test. So we were very encouraged with that. And also we included some peers, some videos, some of the novel technology that not only in our own studies, but in other studies across the nation, they have found that if you want to reach those kids, then you need to look at where they get their information and what is influencing them.
And what kind of website were they going to?
It's a website that we developed with University of Illinois Extension. It was called, is called the HOT Project, Healthy Outcomes for Teens. Up until now, it's been just a research website, but it should be coming out through Illinois Extension for public use in about 2 to 3 weeks. And it has background information for the teachers to include in offline discussions on healthy eating and physical activity.
And would this be a site also that parents would find of use?
We hope so. We haven't modeled it exactly towards parents on that website, but certainly they could go and play the games, look at the videos, that sort of thing with their children. We're developing a separate website for parents of children with diabetes and giving them information that perhaps they haven't had time to get from their doctor or nurse practitioner, other links to other information, help for how to handle the schools if your child has diabetes, because along with this increase in obesity in kids has also come earlier diagnosis with diabetes.
Okay. Healthy Outcomes for Teens.
The HOT Project.
The HOT Project. Okay. So if people are interested, they could Google that and
yes,
they'd be right there. Now, what's the age range for who do you hope you're reaching here with this with this particular project in terms of ages?
We've been targeting middle school, so 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And we have found some differences among the ages. Surprisingly, the 6th graders are more enthusiastic and have better attitudes than the 8th graders, although having had kids that age, I shouldn't be all that surprised. 8th graders are going on to other interests rather than healthy eating and physical activity.
Okay. So what have you learned from the children about what their interests are and what kinds of materials they would find useful on this website?
Well, we've gone back to those kids and done focus groups with them, but because, again, I really feel strongly that if you do things to people, it doesn't work. And in our first round of focus groups, we really got a lot of information that suggested that we needed to have more social interaction, more rating of different activities or healthy plates, what's your favorite, and sharing. They wanted to see what their friends thought about things. And the second time we were looking at that data, that many of the kids felt that that was distracting, that they weren't really learning the materials if they were worrying about what their friends were thinking. And so it's conflicting, but I think not going overboard, we haven't learned an awful lot about how far do you go in edutainment, so to speak, before it's a distraction and not really an education.
Yeah.
We do that at the campus level, too. You can be very entertaining when you're teaching, and at some point, all you hear is the song and you don't hear the words.
Yeah. Well, what about younger children and older children? I would imagine that you're interested in what they need and what they would find useful.
Mm-hmm. Well, for younger children, then the parents really are more of the role model, hopefully. Then once they're in the middle school, they're starting to see their independence and looking at their peers more. With younger kids, the parents still are the gatekeepers to food. The schools are the other gatekeeper. And so really looking at how that family unit works together is very important.
Yeah. Lots of stresses on families. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for families that are, you know, struggling with time demands and budget demands in terms of being a good gatekeeper and putting a healthy meal on the table a couple times a day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that's very helpful to families and to children, if you think about, and you surely do every day, maybe not at the top of your head, I'm not meaning to say parents don't, but think about raising someone who is independent and can do this on their own. And really the way to do that then is to involve the kids in the meal planning and the cooking. And then they know those skills and they're comfortable with that as an adult.
Yeah. This is Focus, and we're talking this morning about diet and nutrition with Professor Karen Chapman Novakovsky of the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's take another call. This is a listener on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Can you hear me well?
Yes. There's a little bit of a buzz, but go ahead. We can hear you.
Okay. Well, I wanted to make a few comments about the material today. Basically, I agree that it's nice to parent your children in a way that models for them good human interaction. And yes, the older they are, the more important you might have to use those skills in order to get them to be cooperative, et cetera, et cetera. Very few people like receiving drill sergeant orders, et cetera, et cetera. However, if you haven't blown it, if you've done a really fine job from birth to 3 years old, approximately, the children will eat what you put in front of them. They will not snack when you tell them not to snack. So you have to learn to do it well in the beginning. And then everything gets easier afterwards. The next point I want to make is that cooking with salt maybe isn't usually even needed. Now you can get David or somebody to work this out with Doyle when he's on, but I'll bet he'll agree. The advantage medically is that if your children never learn to acculturate themselves to eating food that has been prepared with a modest or even amount of salt, they don't grow up thinking that that's what it has to taste like, and therefore it's much easier for them to eat food with minimum salt.
And
the last thing I want to say is that everybody should stay relaxed and not get too worked up. And if you're a guest at someone's house and they have a fairly salty meal, even if you're on blood pressure medicine and diuretics, your body can handle one evening of eating some salty food. So stay calm.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, and I'm going to jump in now because the line was a little noisy there. A number of things the caller commented on for you, our guest, the issue of upbringing, and what you're used to, and enjoying life. Those were, I think, the three things that he hit upon.
I think
there.
So. And I'm certainly, my area is not in parental upbringing or child development, but we do work with those professors and people who know that area much better than I do. As far as, do you have to be really strict with your diet all the time? Do you enjoy life and so forth? Then I absolutely agree. You do the best that you can do every day, and some days, you know, that's not going to work out so great. A number of other countries include in their dietary guidelines that you should enjoy life and enjoy your family. We haven't gone that way. I think it's maybe we're in a hurry, or maybe it's presumed that we do, but certainly enjoying the friendship of a meal is important.
Yeah. Let's take another call. This is a listener. No, we don't have another listener joining us at the moment, but let me invite folks to do so. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, I said in my promo and in my introduction that we would spend a little time talking about heart health as February's American Heart Month. Give us some tips on what we might do to do a little better.
Well, one of the leading causes of cardiovascular disease, of course, is high blood pressure. And the recommended eating pattern for that is not just sodium. It's called the DASH diet, the dietary approaches to stop hypertension. And that includes, as we've been talking about all along, appropriate calories, because gaining weight, being overweight, certainly is going to put a stress on your heart. It includes the right amount of calcium, which goes right along with what we were talking about with osteoporosis, and then more fruits and vegetables to provide some of the minerals that have, like potassium, magnesium, that have a positive effect on heart health, and of course, lower sodium. Then there's the fat. Lowering saturated fat and trans fat then has become just as important as overall calories.
Yeah. Maybe you would talk with us a little bit about what the plate should look like at a meal in terms of vegetables and fruits. What's the breakdown?
Well, if you go to myplate.gov, again, you have the breakdown there. It's about 1/4 protein and about 1/4 starch, and then the other side are vegetables. But again, I think that we need to look at our own plates before we decide what we're going to change. Unfortunately, when we came out with the eat 5 fruits and vegetables, a lot of people just added that on top of what they were already eating. And so a lot of that then was in the form of juice. So did everything the same, added 2 glasses of juice, and guess what?
A lot of calories.
Gained a few pounds, right?
Yeah.
So before adding anything or taking anything off, again, I think looking at what your plate looks like at lunch and dinner time and breakfast as well is a good start. And then taking one step at a time.
Yeah, okay. So you've got to know what you are doing. You said that earlier.
Yes.
In terms of the calcium.
Yes.
The same thing. Let's take another call. This is a listener on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there.
Yeah. Did I understand a little earlier your guest to talk about a connection between sodium and loss of calcium in osteoporosis?
Mm-hmm.
What is that connection?
Well, with higher sodium diets, you can lose more calcium in the urine. And so a lower sodium diet helps prevent that increased loss of calcium in the urine.
Wow. Why have I never heard this connection before? Is this something new?
It's not new as far as I know, but I live in a different world, so I have my nose in the books all the time during the day. But, you know, I would say that we focused a lot on increasing calcium, and that effect is not as great is if you have an adequate calcium diet. You're not losing as much in the urine, but lots of things affect calcium metabolism, and sodium is certainly one of them.
Well, I'll be. Well, I thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this morning. What are some of the other things that might affect our ability to hang on to the calcium?
Well, a lot has been made of caffeine and calcium and oxalate or phytates and fiber. Really, those are probably seem to be less important than things like sodium in the diet. Although our body is really smart, and if you don't have enough calcium in your diet, then you absorb more. Now, this doesn't go on forever, certainly, because you could say, well, I'm just going to forget about calcium and let my intestines make up for it and absorb more. So it doesn't really quite balance out that way. But certainly if you're pregnant or lactating, the absorption of calcium goes up. Your body knows that it needs that. Usually we only absorb about 25 to 30% of what we consume. And that's factored into account when those calcium recommendations are made.
Hmm. I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier about the five a day. And I thought that's really interesting. How do people who are educators and people who are concerned about health, public health people, how do they tailor, how do they make an education program that works for us?
Well, there's a lot of science that goes behind the scenes before the public health messages come out. That didn't work out so well when we came out with my pyramid, and that people mm-hmm. didn't understand what those stripes were, although there were a lot of focus groups, a lot of discussions with people across the nation, men and women, different age groups, and so forth. So we use what we call an evidence-based analysis to find out what is the best practices. And then we talk to people about, do you understand what this means or not? And most of the time we're successful, and sometimes it backfires.
Okay. What do you think of my plate?
I think my plate is a very easy educational tool that we've used for education for people with diabetes for a long time. The key there, and when I used to teach nutrition to medical students, I would tell them, you know, make sure that your patients, if you only have 5 minutes to talk about diet, make sure they understand how big that plate should be.
Yeah.
And it really should be about the size of some of those less expensive paper plates and not some of those, you know, 14-inch across nice china that we have.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is, you know, a serving size of one item is not a serving size for another item, which can also be kind of hard to keep in your head. Like a serving size of nuts is not, you know, you want to keep that pretty small. On the other hand, if you want to have carrots, you know, go for broke, right?
Right, right, right. There are a number of little tricks that you can think of when you're trying to think about portion sizes. One of the more common ones is that 3 ounces of meat, for instance, is about the size of the palm of your hand and about that thick. Or, you know, a half a cup of something is, or a whole cup is about the size of your fist. So if you want a fourth a cup of nuts, then that's about a fourth of the size of your fist.
Yeah. What do you think of, we're going to have to wrap it up pretty quickly, but I'm wondering what you think about community initiatives to improve health in terms of infrastructure. For example, in Champaign-Urbana, we've seen a lot of bike lanes appear over the last couple of years. How important is a community's infrastructure and in terms of our health and wellness?
Oh, I think they're very important, as important as the individual and the family unit, the schools. But I think the healthy community approach is really vital for sustainability and to provide that surrounding atmosphere that this is the right thing to do.
Yeah. From my perspective, it seems that I have noticed an increase in people walking and biking recently, and I don't know if I'm just all of a sudden paying attention to it or if we are doing more of it in the communities of Champaign and Urbana. Do you have any sense of that?
I think there's definitely been an increase, especially among the bike riding group. I know that it's become very popular and stylish among younger adults, and then with kids, older adults see it as a good way to exercise without pounding their knees into the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. I think it's great.
Okay. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there at this point because we are at the end of our time that we can spend together today. Karen, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us and our listeners today.
Thanks for having me.
Karen Chapman-Novakovsky is a professor of nutrition at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Diet and nutrition is a topic we take up once a month here on Focus. It's part of our commitment at WILL to report on topics of health and wellness.